Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. We are broadcasting this morning from KRCB, the NPR affiliate in Rohnert Park, which is between Petaluma and Santa Rosa. The death toll from the horrific fires here in Northern California has risen to 40. As of this morning, 99 people are still unaccounted for. The fires have scorched more than 220,000 acres, destroying or damaging over 5,500 structures. Because people are finally returning to their homes, the number of evacuees dropped overnight from 100,000 to 75,000. It was the deadliest week for California wild urban fires on record. Luckily, most of the fires have been contained by just over about 50%, but this situation is still fluid and very dangerous. Firefighters are closely watching the Oakmont area in Santa Rosa. Today, we're going to talk about what explains the destructive nature of these fires. How is climate change, urban development, the intermixing of wild and urban spaces, and other factors contributing to the frequency of severity of these present day fires? And before we dive in, I just want to give you a quick update of what I've been seeing. I went to a number of shelters in Petaluma yesterday. So many people have been evacuated to Petaluma. On Sunday night, there were new evacuations. So there are a lot of people in need. But the generosity has just been so amazing. A number of shelters are turning away volunteers and donations because they have been flooded with donations and volunteers. And what I'm hearing from a lot of people on the ground at this point is that they're concerned that when the next tragedy hits, the TV cameras will go away and the donations will go away. And so if you want to get involved, maybe call in 2 weeks, call in a month, because there's going to be need for months and years to come. But the generosity has been just incredible. In fact, a lot of people are saying that there is at least one volunteer for every person who has been evacuated. Joining us on today's show is Gregory Simon. He's associate professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Denver and author of the book Flame and Fortune in the American West: Urban Development, Environmental Change, and the Great Oakland Hills Fire. Gregory's family survived the 1991 Oakland Hills fire when he was a teenager. Hi, Gregory. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Matt Weiser, an environmental journalist and contributing editor at Water Deeply. That's an independent digital media project dedicated to covering the water crises in California and the American West. Matt has covered environmental and civic issues for 30 years. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Gregory, I want to start off with you because you've lived through all of this before, unfortunately, and we're having this program close to the 26th anniversary of the Oakland fires, when about 3,400 homes and apartments were destroyed, 25 people died. I just wonder, since you've lived through this, what went through your mind when you were watching these fires take off so rapidly?
Yeah, I guess my initial response was, here we go again, another year, another major series of fires. And you're right, when I wrote the book Flame and Fortune in the American West, it was published right along with the 25th anniversary of that fire. And up until that point, the Oakland Hills fire had been the largest fire in terms of number of structures burned in California history. And that's, you know, saying something given California's long history of wildfires. And a year later, that record no longer stands. We now have the largest fire, these fires in north of the Bay Area, that now stand as the largest sort of fire complex in California history. So as I watched these fires, it definitely brought back memories of you know, kind of the news circulating about a big fire that we weren't quite sure how large it was, and it continued to spread and spread, and the numbers came in, and the number of homes and lives lost, you know, went up over time. And then looking after the fact, or sort of seeing these images of the landscape after the fire, it definitely takes me back to 1991, the look of just sort of that smoldering landscape, the gray landscape, nothing left, maybe a tree or a random home, you know, dotting the landscape that didn't burn down. So it's a very stark reminder of how it was 25, 26 years ago now. And And it's a very sad, sad event. You know, I'm very, really sad to see this, and my thoughts and prayers go out to the people, you know, in Sonoma and Napa County.
Yeah, thank you. It is such a tragic event. Matt Weiser, you have reported on these issues for 30 years. In fact, you used to work for the Press Democrat, a newspaper in Santa Rosa, and they've been doing incredible reporting on the fires. What was your response when you heard about the fire and then watched it spread so rapidly?
Well, I was blown away like most people were. The devastation is just incredible, and it's been surprising to everyone, particularly that so much of the damage occurred in long-settled urban areas of Santa Rosa. So there was that reaction, but I had another reaction, which was that to some extent it was not so much of a surprise, because there's been a lot of rural development in areas of Sonoma County and Napa County that have very high fire danger and very high fuel loads from, both from the great number of trees killed by the drought and by our history of fire suppression in California and the West, which we now know was a misguided policy and has led to many landscapes that are overcrowded with trees and brush that are extremely flammable. And even though we know that, we've been building many houses in amongst all of this fuel.
Right. I grew up in Petaluma, and most of my family is in Santa Rosa, and just seeing the development over the past couple of decades, it's just exploded. To that point, Gregory, the LA Times has a story called "Despite Clear Risks, Santa Rosa Neighborhood That Burned Down Was Exempt from Fire Regulations." And they're specifically focusing on Coffee Park, which was built on city streets, not forested country lanes. Most of Coffee Park, sadly, has been completely demolished. And in this piece, Anna Bruner, whose house still stands, says, quote, "We live in a subdivision in the middle of freaking Santa Rosa. I could see living on the outskirts of the mountains. You always have the potential of fire, but you would never expect it in a subdivision of this size." That's what I'm hearing from a lot of people. They're surprised that the fire would reach a subdivision inside of Santa Rosa.
Yeah, this is really is not that uncommon. This is something, again, that I experienced talking to people. So I've interviewed a lot of people whose homes have burned down in fires around California and the Bay Area and in Oakland as well. And the comment always was, we never thought this would happen here. And, you know, it's odd. You know, at the time, when the Oakland Hills area was built, that was actually a suburb of San Francisco. And when these areas of Sonoma, Petaluma were built, they were suburbs of the Bay Area as well. And now we have suburbs to those suburbs. And so we're sort of just reaching out farther and farther into what were formerly forested, open space, wildland areas that the previous person mentioned experienced many decades and centuries of forest suppression, fire suppression, excuse me. So the thing is that these areas, although they've been there for quite some time, they're highly developed, they feel like very urban neighborhoods, they still sit adjacent to open space. And so if a fire of this size with these types of winds at this time of year when there's been no significant precipitation for, you know, almost 6 months, these fires can sweep right through not just kind of what we think of as these sort of ex-urban kind of rural areas, but they can sweep right through areas that residents themselves would consider to be almost core urban, you know, parts of the Bay Area. And we have to remember that it's not just the trees themselves that fuel the fire, the homes do. So in Coffee Park neighborhood, you know, this is a neighborhood like many other in the area that are sort of, you know, densely populated, lots of homes lining the streets. And so when one house catches fire, another house catches fire, you know, times 10, times, you know, 20, and all of a sudden you've got a major firestorm that can sweep through those areas as if it was sweeping through just a forest.
Mm. Matt, what would you add to that? According to this LA Times piece, because Coffee Park was outside the officially mapped very severe hazard zone, more than 5 miles to the east, Coffee Park was exempt from regulations designed to make buildings fire-resistant in high-risk areas. California fire officials developed hazard maps in the 2000s that, for the very first time, tied building codes to geographies based on risk. But Max Moritz, a fire specialist with the UC Cooperative Extension, said the maps were an important step forward in assessing the fire damage. The catastrophe has shown that the methodology that was used was just too narrow.
Well, that may be true, but this is a problem that comes up whenever building codes are changed, for example. The changes don't generally apply to older homes unless those homes are significantly remodeled or rebuilt. So some of these fire prevention codes include things like fire-resistant siding and certain types of attic vents and roofing materials and so forth. None of those would have applied to Coffee Park or the low-lying neighborhoods that burned down. But what I would also add to this is if we look to the east of Coffee Park, there is a large semi-rural developed area that has been built out over the past two decades. The Fountain Grove area is a hilly, heavily forested neighborhood just to the east of Highway 101 and the Coffee Park area that the way this fire unfolded is that neighborhood became basically a blowtorch that was showering Coffee Park and other low-lying Santa Rosa neighborhoods with flying embers and other burning debris because we had these easterly winds, similar to the Santa Ana winds that we have in Southern California, that drove this fire from east to west and burned down Fountain Grove and showered the rest of Santa Rosa with burning debris. The Fountain Grove neighborhood is identified as a high fire hazard area, and many of those homes are built on ridgetops where the fire was able to rush uphill, torch those houses, which then became part of the material that was burning and flaming all over the rest of Santa Rosa.
Matt Weiser is an environmental journalist and contributing editor at Water Deeply, and Gregory Simon is associate professor at the University of Colorado Denver and author of Flame and Fortune in the American West, Urban Development, Environmental Change, and the Great Oakland Hills Fire. Today on Your Call, it's our One Planet series. Every Monday, we're talking about issues affecting our precious planet, including climate change and these horrific fires, and we're broadcasting today from KRCB, the NPR affiliate, here in Rohnert Park, which is between Petaluma and Santa Rosa. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you have any stories to share, if you lost your home or remember what happened in the Oakland Hills, it's all built again. What changes were actually made during the development process? Because people are having some pretty intense conversations right now about how to rebuild Santa Rosa, parts of Santa Rosa and Napa counties. And I also do not want to forget Mendocino and Lake counties. Unfortunately, most media coverage is focusing on Napa and Sonoma counties, but we cannot forget about Lake County and Mendocino County. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We just recently changed our email address, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Matt, what are your thoughts about how these issues are covered in the media? Because a couple days after these fires happen, there's a lot of reporting on climate change, and then there's reporting on development. There's reporting on whether power lines may have played a role here. I'm looking at a piece in the MIT Technology Review. It says, did climate change fuel California's devastating fires? Probably. What are your thoughts about the different factors and how they are being reported?
Well, The climate change piece is getting a fair amount of attention now. I can't say that it got enough attention previously. We just concluded a five-year drought in California that killed something like 105 million trees. Let's just pause and think about that number. 105 million trees killed by the drought in California. But those trees are only on national forest lands, which are primarily in interior areas of California. The number does not include dead trees in the Santa Rosa area or elsewhere in the wine country that burned up in these fires. We know that the climate change contributed to the drought, and therefore it contributed to this huge number of dead trees, which are part of the fire problem we're seeing now. Another thing that has not received enough media attention is the problem of the wildland-urban interface, which is the very problem that is driving these fires. For decades, we've been building too many homes in areas of high fire risk. And an example is this Fountain Grove area of Santa Rosa that I mentioned earlier. We have not restricted development enough in these areas, and once we have homes in there, we don't do enough to deal with the fire risk. An example of this is a fee that the state imposed on rural homeowners to cover fire prevention in the wildland-urban interface. It raised something like $320 million in the 6 years after it was approved in 2011, and then just this year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a cap-and-trade bill that had within its language the elimination of that fee. So that fee no longer exists, and the many fire prevention agencies in California that are trying to build fire breaks and thin out overgrown fuels have lost a very important source of money as a result. And that change in the law has received very little attention.
Gregory, what are your thoughts? What would you add to that? How do you think this is being reported, and what do you think is missing from the coverage?
So I think that the coverage has really misled the public as to the drivers, the major drivers of these fires. If you look at the coverage coming out just after the kind of everyone sort of recognized the severity of these fires, the language that was being used was stuff like, this is a perfect storm. And the idea of a perfect storm, and the perfect storm was that we had dry conditions, high winds, the fire sort of really got going at night, and lots of vegetation and a lot of dead vegetation. All very important factors. But the problem with this kind of use of the language of a perfect storm is that it implies that it crept up on us as if we didn't know it was coming, right? It just sort of happened to us. And in some respects, yes, it did kind of develop overnight, and so it did sort of creep up on us and surprise us a bit. But on the other hand, if you look at the state of California and you look at fires in California over the last century and certainly over the last 20, 30, 40 years, it's no surprise. No one should be surprised that these disasters are happening with the magnitude and severity that they are. We know they're coming. We know that next year there'll be another fire just like this or something similar to it. So I think that it really underplays the fact that we know the trouble that we're putting ourselves into. We know that we're putting ourselves in harm's way. And specifically by building homes and continuing to allow homes and residential developments to encroach further and further out away from cities. I guess I'm a bit critical, actually, of media coverage. This is the language I've written about this, and this is what a lot of the book is about. It's about how we talk about fires. Certainly implicating climate change in the process is important. You know, climate change is contributing to increased aridity, changing precipitation patterns, longer fire seasons, and so on. But I think that the public is being led to believe, and sort of urban planners and developers are being exonerated from their role, from the role of kind of urban development, urban expansion, as really being a key driver to this problem. I mean, we would care about these fires, but we wouldn't care so much about them if we didn't have thousands of homes in harm's way, right? They'd just be, we'd be interested in the satellite imagery of this large fire burning in Northern California, burning lots of forest. Well, that's actually the natural order of things. Forests do burn periodically. it's actually good ecologically. But it's because we have all of our human assets in the way that we care. So I think that really should be brought out more in the media. It's increasingly being talked about, but I'm surprised how frequently that key factor, this isn't a natural disaster, this is a man-made disaster, how that kind of gets left out of the story.
Matt, I know we have to let you go in a couple minutes, so why don't we tackle this issue? What you had a piece, what needs to be done to stop wildfires and drought-killed forests. But when you're talking about these urban areas at a time when so many people are leaving small towns because it's so difficult to find a job, the population just continues to grow. What we're seeing in Northern California is because the Bay Area is so expensive, so many people are coming north. In fact, Santa Rosa has seen some of the highest rent increases in the entire state of California. A lot of people are moving to these areas. Based on the reporting you've done, what have you heard from experts about how to tackle this?
Well, I think one of the first things people have to understand is that fires are natural, and we need fire to control the fire danger that we have. So people have to get more comfortable with the idea of controlled burns in order to reduce the fuel loading in and around the places where they live. And that includes sometimes dealing with the nuisance of smoke, but not on the scale, obviously, that we've seen with these huge fires. So small controlled fires are something that we need to do more of. We also need to do more of what they call mechanical thinning, which is sort of a small form of logging where you remove smaller trees and brush and either burn those or process them in a biofuel plant to make energy. The other thing people have to do is they have to take responsibility for their own property to maintain a defensible space around their homes. There's a lot of evidence that that wasn't done in many of the communities that burned in these fires. A lot of times people don't want to cut down trees around their home because they like them as part of the landscaping and the scenery. But in many of these towns, it's just something people have to do.
Let's take a call, and maybe you can answer this question before we go to break. Let's go to Roberta. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. It's my understanding that there was an awful lot of arcing from the transformers of PG&E lines and power lines and the transformers themselves that might have contributed to this. And I'm wondering, you know, shouldn't there be, especially in what we're talking about here, an ecological aspect of putting the lines underground so it doesn't happen again like this? I just think it makes sense.
Well, thank you for that. We spoke briefly about that earlier this, or last week. Sorry, I'm not even remembering what day it is at this point. And Matthias Gaffney has another story. Governor Brown vetoed 2016 bill aimed at power line and wildfire safety. Have you been following this at all, Matt? There are some questions about downed power lines and whether these power lines should be underground instead of above ground. Have you reported on that?
I haven't personally reported on that, but it's, I mean, it's certainly a good idea in some areas, but it would, as with the fire prevention efforts, it would lead to more cost for everyone who pays a power bill to those utilities. So if it's something we want to do for fire safety, people are going to have to be prepared for higher utility bills, I suspect. So again, it's one of these costs we may have to accept for living in fire-prone areas.
Matt Weiser is an environmental journalist and contributing editor at Water Deeply, an independent digital media project covering the water crises in California and the American West, and they do really great work. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with Gregory Simon, Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Denver. Gregory is author of Flame and Fortune in the American West. His family survived the 1991 Oakland Hills fire when he was a teenager. And on today's Your Call, it's our One Planet series. We're broadcasting from KRCB, the NPR affiliate here in Rohnert Park, and we're talking about the devastating Northern California fires. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our One Planet series. Every Monday, we will talk about our precious planet and climate change, fires. Today, we're talking about the devastating fires here in Northern California. It was the deadliest week for California wild urban fires on record. The death toll has risen to 40. As of this morning, 99 people are unaccounted for. 5,500 buildings and homes have been destroyed. People are starting to return to their homes, and so the number of evacuees dropped overnight from 100,000 to 75,000. But still, that is a massive number of people who've been evacuated. I went to a couple of shelters yesterday, and the outpouring of support has been amazing. Shelters are overwhelmed with volunteers and donations. Unless you live in the area, what a number of volunteer coordinators are saying is check in 2 weeks or a month. At that time, they're afraid that the TV cameras are going to go away and the need will still be so great. And there's a lot of great resources online. Today, we're joined by Gregory Simon, Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Denver, and he's author of Flame and Fortune in the American West, Urban Development, Environmental Change, and the Great Oakland Hills Fire. His family survived the 91 Oakland Hills Fire when he was a teenager. Gregory, before we move on to other calls, what are your thoughts about Roberta's concern? A lot of people are now talking about PG&E wire lines and whether they should go underground. What kind of difference would that make?
Yep. So, I wanted to also address that, too. I'm glad we revisited this. So power lines are a major concern for a variety of reasons. One, there's this sort of phenomenon called power line arcing, where the heat sort of from the fires underneath power lines can actually cause them to explode in certain ways and actually create more sparks that actually then can fly and land on more roofs and create danger in that way. They can also fall and block roads, not allowing people to escape by car. And, of course, the lines themselves, I'm talking about the telephone poles with the power lines on them. And then also you have the line being downed and actually creating a hazard for people fleeing or running around the streets. In many fires, people have been electrocuted by these lines. So they are a very real concern. The problem is that to change the current power line structure and put them underground, as one would imagine, is very expensive. And so what typically happens is that, and I'll be very curious to see what happens in the North Bay, is after a fire event like this, they sort of use this event as an impetus to then put the lines underground. And now, of course, that's after the fact, it's too late. Because you sort of have everything in disrepair, this is the opportunity then to make these sort of wholesale changes to urban infrastructure. And you see this a lot also with water mains and water lines in fire areas, that frequently these water lines and mains were put in and they really didn't have the bandwidth, so to speak, to sustain adequate firefighting capabilities with water. And after the fire, because everything again is in disrepair and they're going in and modifying things, they use that opportunity to implement newer, you know, wider, more powerful water infrastructure as well. This is part of the, I think your previous comment was, the question was about what happens after the fire. And these are all things that should happen. They should make this area more sort of fire resistant, fire resilient in the future.
And in order to do that, legislators would have to take action, right?
Exactly. So it's going to take either legislators, passing a bill to fund this sort of activity, or there'll have to be a bond measure put in place. Some areas have sort of done these hybrid, sort of if legislation passes, the residents have agreed to also take on extra responsibility, maybe a local tax of some kind, to support these types of infrastructure improvements.
All right. Well, thank you again for your call, Roberta. Let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Thanks for doing this. I was just wondering, in terms of infrastructure and repair, how would solar feature into this in terms of power lines? Would, if you had solar on every house, maybe make it mandatory in the rebuilding effort, would that mitigate, you know, some of the issues that that you're talking about, putting the power lines underground?
Thanks, Mo. What about solar, Gregory?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I don't have a great answer for that. I mean, on the one hand, it would relieve a lot of the pressure in terms of the flow of electricity from the power generation units to the homes, right? They'd be generating their own power. But I'm afraid that you would still have, in my understanding of the solar power and, you know, kind of infrastructure that to the main grid and then kind of shared and distributed. So I think we'd still have a lot of the power lines in place. Question of how resilient to embers are the solar panels themselves sitting on the rooftops. Obviously, that's a major way in which fires spread, is by flying embers, you know, flying from a, you know, a nearby adjacent area onto homes, kind of the front of the fire spreading in that way. And I don't know to what extent solar panels would disable or enable or really have no impact on the spread of fires based on these flying embers landing on roofs.
Gregory, what about the rebuilding process? I mean, people in Coffee Park, Fountain Grove, a number of places in Santa Rosa and other parts of Sonoma County are starting to have conversations about the rebuilding process and what changes should be made. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of concerns about affordable housing. We'll definitely talk about that on another show. But when it comes to making changes, what do you recommend? Are there examples you can point to in other parts of the country that you think have done it right? I mean, there's a lot of different interests involved in this. Where do you begin?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, one of the biggest issues that the residents in these counties are going to be facing who are coming back to their destroyed homes, of course, is the insurance or the insurance companies, and dealing with them and trying to figure out ways to get fair compensation, you know, for their loss. And so that's going to be a major issue. And I think that one of the things that residents can do is talk with one another and share stories about, you know, maybe issues they're having with insurance companies and get settling the claims. That's been, in my experience, has been a really useful way for residents to come together and challenge, you know, some of the problems that arise. So that's always, I mean, you ask people about sort of the risks and the loss and the hardships associated with fires. Of course, there is the, you know, the injury, bodily injury, loss of life, loss of property, loss of memories, loss of keepsakes, all of those things. But the next issue that always comes up is the hardships of dealing with the insurance claim. So I would definitely suggest that residents create a forum for, whether it's online or in person, for sharing their stories and you know, essentially maybe enabling kind of collective action if that needs to come, if that has to happen. The second issue is around the rebuilding process, is the construction of homes. In some of my analysis in both Colorado and California, post-fire, is that the homes that are rebuilt after fires are significantly bigger than the homes before. And they are closer together, about 10 to 14% larger and 10 to 14% closer together. 10 to 14 feet closer together. And so, you know, that suggests two things. One, it suggests that people are trying to get, understandably, more out of the insurance claim as they can. And by that, I mean adding an extra bedroom, adding some square footage, things of that nature. But what that also means, of course, is that you know, you're putting more fuel on the landscape, you're putting more home, and you're putting that times hundreds and times thousands in this case. And so that's also somewhat contradictory to the production of a fire-safe landscape when you're putting larger homes that are closer together, right, and that kind of enables the spread between homes. Obviously, the last thing is that because these homes were destroyed, they will come under, or they will have to comply with stricter fire construction standards. So these homes should be built with fire-safe roofs, you know, adequate attic kind of space provisions, reduction of eaves along the side of homes, and things like that that So that's a good thing. But so they'll probably have more fire-safe construction, but what I've seen in my own research is that the homes are bigger and kind of better than before.
Wow. How do you get people to really tackle what you call the wildland-urban interface? I mean, your book really tackles this issue specifically and looks at the shortcomings of this.
So when you say tackle the wildland-urban interface, you mean managing it to reduce fire risk?
Well, how do you get people to really, like for example, in Santa Rosa, there should be, and many communities, these community forums to really discuss the issues that you're bringing to the table before, and of course, it's easy to say that when you haven't lost your house and all of your things, but before you move to build a big home in the same area, mm-hmm. how do you get communities to really talk about these issues?
That's a really good question, and it's a very difficult one. I think that in times like this, as we've seen with the outpouring of support, the communities tend to come together and really support one another. The sense of community sort of rises. I think that this dialogue and these interactions have to continue into the future to make sure or ensure that communities do the proper provisions in terms of tree thinning and, you know, creating preventable or defensible space around homes and neighborhoods. I mean, there are Cal Fire has a series of programs that exist that provide sort of basic lessons and information and for getting communities to band together on sort of a neighborhood level to plan in these ways. But in terms of, you know, home construction, you know, these are private properties, and, you know, individuals are going to make decisions that are best for themselves. And of course, there's a review process for all new buildings that are, you know, proposed. They have to conform with the, you know, neighborhood aesthetics and so on. But generally speaking, individuals are going to act on their own interests. But certainly when it comes to sort of protecting the community through vegetation management and things like that, there are ways in which the communities, neighborhoods can band together and kind of create meetings and forums to make collective decisions for the best, you know, for the best interests of everyone. Because, of course, if it takes everyone to agree to these. I mean, a fire like this, as we saw, sweeps through the entire neighborhood. So one resident, one homeowner making responsible decisions doesn't amount to much if no one else is. So everyone has to contribute.
Gregory Simon is Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, and author of Flame and Fortune in the American West, Urban Development, Environmental Change, and the Great Oakland Hills Fire. Gregory's family survived the 1991 Oakland Hills Fire when he was a teenager. And today on Your Call, it's our One Planet series. We're broadcasting from KRCB, the NPR affiliate in Rohnert Park, which is between Petaluma and Santa Rosa. The air is still very, very thick. And yesterday I noticed that a lot of people were walking around without their masks because you really didn't smell the fire yesterday. But a lot of health officials say even if you don't smell it, you should still wear that mask just to protect your health. Really, really important. If you have any questions or comments for today's show, if you have a story to share, a personal story about Sonoma, Napa, Lake, or Mendocino County. If you live through the Oakland Fire, we'd love to hear from you. What changes would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I have a question that your previous guest brought up, which is about controlled burns. And he said that there needs to be more controlled burns. I'm a little confused because when I was back in college 40 years ago, I was taught that controlled burns was the procedure of the Forest Service and accepted as the necessity for maintaining fire prevention. So is that not happening? And if it's not happening, why isn't it?
Thanks, Lisa. Gregory?
It has been the practice for quite some time. However, I think that the kind of level of implementation could be increased. So I think it's generally understood that prescribed burns, kind of along, peripheral to urban developments and around other kind of developed areas, is something that we've seen quite a bit. And in fact, if you drive around, you know, kind of peri-urban California, you see a lot of these burns. Sort of off in the distance, you see little piles of, you know, smoke coming up. So we do them. I think probably what the previous caller was referencing was a lack of commitment to it on a broader scale.
What would you like to see when it comes to controlled burns? We've got another email about that.
Well, I think I would agree with what was said previously, which is that kind of implementing this practice on a broader level, and really doing more diligent work to identify locations where this practice could be implemented more directly and more frequently. It would be important. I think that, you know, I mean, again, one of the problems with a fire of this magnitude is that some of the fire breaks and sort of controlled burns that occurred would really have a hard time stopping a fire of this size. But on the other hand, there are occasions where without the proper fire mitigation practice, the prescribed burn practice, fires have spread farther than they would have needed to. So I think there are places and locations, especially for the kind of small to medium fires, where these types of activities would be actually much more, would be very beneficial if they were implemented more broadly across the state.
Also, what really struck you, Gregory, about how these fires spread so quickly? According to the Press Democrat, the fire traveled at a pace of 3 miles per hour, burning up about an acre a minute while spewing burning embers a half mile or more ahead, forcing entire neighborhoods to flee. Eric Hoffman, a retired assistant chief with Cal Fire, who rejoined the state's fire agency to help manage this fire, he's calculating the fire's speed, and he said, quote, "For a fire to move that fast is incredible." What are your thoughts on that?
It really is fascinating and you know, frightening to learn about or to hear about those types of statistics. And again, if you know, in California and other areas of the West where there are these prevailing kind of dry easterly winds that occur on occasion and really at the wrong time of year, right, in kind of a very arid, kind of very dry, you know, early fall, late summer months, that is partly to blame for these fast-moving fires. But also the fire itself, when you have a fire of this size move across the landscape with all of this fuel on the landscape, I'm not just talking about trees and vegetation, I'm talking about the homes themselves, fueling the fire, and it gets bigger and bigger. Actually, what has been described by many fire scientists is a sort of firestorm phenomenon, whereby it creates its own winds. So no longer, I mean, of course, the easterly winds, the Santa Ana winds and so on, coming from the east, drive the fire, but the fire itself begins to generate its own wind pattern because you have this massive vortex of heat rising and wind is, you know, driving into the fire to fill that vacuum as the heat rises. And it actually fuels the fire even more and pushes it across this landscape. It's much like a hurricane across warm ocean waters. Like the warmer the water, the more that hurricane is able to kind of self-generate and continue and grow. And in the same way, the more fuel there is on the ground in the form of homes, the fire is able to kind of maintain itself and grow and pick up speed and sweep through landscapes really quickly. And of course, the problem with this is that for residents living nearby, the fire is on top of them before they know it. And this is particularly a problem, acute problem for elderly residents. And if you look at the list of people who passed away in the fire, I haven't looked at the exact numbers, but what you're probably going to notice is that many of them were elderly. This is certainly the case in the Oakland Hills fire.
Right.
Yeah.
That is the case here. I don't have the specific numbers, but we've got the death toll is 40, and just 2 days ago, I did watch a few press conferences, and they said most of the people who passed away were elderly, and a couple of mobile home parks completely mm-hmm. burned down, mm-hmm. inhabited by people who are elderly. A lot of people who are elderly are in evacuation centers, and they are in need, especially for overnight shifts, for nurses, doctors, home care workers. I mean, people need help going to the bathroom. Just, you know, a lot of people have lost their in-home support network because of the fires. So that's also just really devastating, and we will definitely continue to give you updates about that. If anyone can provide those services, you can email us and we can let you know how to get in touch with the various shelters that are in need of that assistance. Well, thank you for calling, Lisa. Let's go next to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show. Did we lose Mark? I think Mark wanted to know if we should be wearing masks in San Francisco. Mother Jones had a piece a couple days ago called California's Raging Fires Have Turned into a Public Health Crisis. Gregory, I know you're not a public health expert, but you have lived through this before. When I was visiting shelters yesterday, I had my mask on for most of the day, but when I took it off, I mean, my throat was really hurting and my nose felt odd. Do you think that as a precaution, people should wear their masks even if they're not smelling smoke?
Yes, I think you should. I think certainly in the areas, the times of day or the days when the wind is sort of blowing in the right direction, and you can visually sort of see when it's more hazy that that might be a time to wear a mask. If you have one, I would certainly suggest wearing it. As time passes and we sort of move farther and farther away from the fire, the need to do that will decrease. But I'll also say that, you know, if you think about what burns in a fire, it's not just wood. It's things like plastic. It's mm-hmm. corrosives, you know, paint that people have in their garage, things like that are actually toxins that make their way into the atmosphere. Now, a lot of these toxins don't have a high, residence time. They don't last for very long in the atmosphere. So if you're down in San Francisco, you may not be, getting that type of material. But if you're anywhere nearby the fire area, I certainly would suggest, and certainly if you're revisiting, kind of going back into the neighborhood, I would advise wearing a mask. There's a lot of nasty stuff that the fire burns through. And so it either is in the atmosphere or it's kind of burned and still on the ground, but it's still releasing volatile organic compounds and things like that and hydrocarbons into the atmosphere locally. So certainly for people revisiting the fire area, I think it's very wise to keep a mask on.
Yes, and you can find this Mother Jones piece. We'll put it on our website. Bay Area Quality Management District spokesman Tom Flanagan is quoted as saying, "These are unprecedented conditions. We've measured some of the highest air pollution ratings in the Bay Area ever recorded. Arsenic, cadmium, copper, lead, so many different toxins are now in the air. So it's better to take precaution." We have time, and we'll actually do a show specifically on this because it's such an important issue. We have time for another question. Let's go to Patty in San Francisco. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I was concerned regarding the trees that were weakened by the drought and then killed off by the beetles, how that may have contributed to the fire.
All right, thank you. What about that, Gregory?
So there's sort of competing science on this. Some have argued that the pine beetle kill, the vast amounts of forest across the West that have been killed by this beetle have made them more prone to fire because they've basically killed them and they've created sort of this dry, landscape. Almost like kindling on the landscape for fire just to move right through. And I've heard other people say that, yes, that's true, but it's hard to distinguish that effect from just the effects of climate change, which, of course, are associated with the pine beetle, but the effect of climate change being just warmer, more arid climate with less water, and that's led also to, kind of more desiccated, drier forests, coupled with the role of urban development in all of this. That generally speaking, what I've seen from the science is that the greatest predictor of sort of trees and fuels burning to a fire is their proximity to human development, because that's where people visit, that's where people drop cigarettes and things of that nature, and that's where we modify the landscape. So I think there are several factors that contribute to this. I think it's fair to say that pine beetle and climate change have a major role in this. But I always just don't want to keep too far off in the distance the role that human developments and our, the ways in which we've modified the landscape have changed things as well.
We have an email from Nancy who says, after the Oakland Hills fire, we were helped tremendously by United Policyholders. Mm-hmm. It's uphelp.org, uphelp.org. She says they're super at helping homeowners negotiate the disaster process. I was just hearing this morning on the radio, I don't remember the station, but on the radio, a woman who lost everything said, we lost all of our documents and we're so confused. I mean, a lot of people are already just traumatized by the experience, but to have to go through all of this is so difficult. This is up and running in Santa Rosa. And then at the Petaluma Fairgrounds, there is a State Farm makeshift office in the parking lot. So if you need access to that, that is there. There's so many resources online. And if you need any help with any links, you can email us and we can send you a few. Gregory, final thoughts? I mean, there's just so much at this point. I mean, people were evacuated just two nights ago, and right now we're watching the Oakmont fire, hoping that that doesn't continue to rage.
Yeah, there's a lot, obviously. No, nothing I could say, you know, in this short period of time would be sufficient. But I just say, we'll say United Policyholders absolutely have heard nothing but great stories about them. That actually gets back to the point I was making before about people learning from each other, and they're there to help. But with respect to final thoughts, you know, I just hope that the state of California and across the West can do more to acknowledge the role that urban planners and developers have in creating these human-made disasters. And, you know, I think it's in everyone's best interest, taxpayers, the people who live in cities and urban and kind of exurban, suburban areas, to really think long and hard about how we plan cities. And, you know, prevent these types of hazards and disasters from occurring in the future.
Gregory Simon is Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, and author of Flame and Fortune in the American West, Urban Development, Environmental Change, and the Great Oakland Hills Fire. Gregory's family survived the 1991 Oakland Hills Fire when he was a teenager. Gregory, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about your book.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Your Call is produced at KALW. Today, we've been broadcasting from KRCB, the NPR affiliate in Rohnert Park. Thank you to the team here at KRCB. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, and you can leave us a review. You can follow us on Twitter, at Your Call Radio. Malihe Raz is on produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.